Are digital technologies making politics impossible? It's an intriguing question. In fact, it was the inaugural question posed by the Nine Dots Prize, an award designed to encourage creative thinking on contemporary societal issues. The best answer to that question received $100,000 in prize money and a book deal with Cambridge University Press. The winner was James Williams, a doctoral researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute at Oxford University, where his research focuses on the philosophy and ethics of technology. He also spent over 10 years working for Google. His award-winning entry was called Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Persuasion in the Attention Economy.
I think attention economy is a shorthand term for this environment of competition for our attention that most of our technologies we use every day are involved in. You know, we think about the ethics of technology, the implications of technology, I think a lot in informational terms. Mm-hmm. But you know, if you look at what they're really competing for, it's our attention. It's attention that, you know, I'm giving you, you're giving me, your listeners are giving us right now. That's literally the object of competition for most of the technologies we use every day.
That's part of my conversation with James Williams. I spoke to him almost exactly 1 year ago when he was announced as the winner of the Nine Dots Prize. Now, 1 year later, he's finished the book based on that entry, and we thought it was time for another chat.
I got the book done. Yeah, it was after writing a book after doing a PhD is sort of like doing a sprint at the end of a marathon. That's
right.
How I think about it.
James thinks that to do anything that matters in our life, we have to be able to pay attention to the things that matter. But with digital technologies all competing for our attention, we end up living very distracted lives. So what does all this have to do with politics? Well, in Stand Out of Our Light, James readily admits he used to think there were no great political struggles left. But he now believes that the liberation of human attention may be the defining moral and political struggle of our time. So one of the points that you make early on in the book is that there's this deep misalignment between the goals that we have for ourselves and the goals that our technologies have for us. So what do you mean by that?
I think if you look at, you know, a lot of these digital platforms that we use day to day and kind of trust to guide our life, by and large, kind of the goals they have, the success metrics are, you know, what people call engagement metrics. So things like the amount of time we spend or the number of clicks or number of times we view pages or ads, this sort of thing. So I think that it's this idea that, you know, the things that we want to do with ourselves, with our lives, the things that we'll regret not having done, the things that I think technology exists to help us do, aren't really kind of represented in the system and aren't really sort of incentives that are driving the design of most of these technologies of our attention today.
And one of the things you talk about is the role of advertising in all this, how advertising is in part the goals of our digital services as well. Of course, advertising has long tried to capture our attention, but what's the difference with digital?
I think there's three main things. I think one is now that we carry it around in our pocket all day, every day, it's sort of unbounded in a way. So it's just this continual flow of, you know, the most interesting things the world has to show me, kind of yearning for my attention, you know, from the time I wake up to the time I go to sleep. I think another piece is the sort of vastly improved intelligence, the way that it can kind of target the right reward at the right person at the right time. In the past, it was very hard to kind of measure the effectiveness of advertising of any kind of, you know, media persuasion. Mm-hmm. But now there's this whole infrastructure of measurement on the internet, of targeting, message delivery. So and then you add to this, you know, these new AI systems. Like, it wasn't widely really noted, but AlphaGo, the system that beat the world champion at the game Go, which was this long desired kind of feat of AI rigor, one of the first five projects it was put toward was the recommendation engine for recommended videos on YouTube.
Really?
So literally, like, if the algorithm that beat the world champion at Go is showing me videos that it thinks will keep me using YouTube longer, like, I just don't, it's just sort of like no contest, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's a kind of more unbounded than ever before, and there's this huge infrastructure of intelligence, I think, that just makes it so much more effective in what it's trying to do. And then I think the third thing that's different, historically speaking, is the centralization of all of this. I mean, just, you know, the idea that one company can shape what 2 billion people plus are thinking and doing on a daily basis. I mean, there's really no historical analog, I think, for this type of power. We don't even really have a good word for it yet.
I mean, I think most of us have seen how ubiquitous and always-on technology like a smartphone affects us personally, but you're also arguing in the book that it's actually affecting us on a societal level. So why do you think these particular tools have so thoroughly managed to capture the attention of an entire society?
Well, I think when we talk about attention, and this is one of the things I do in the book, is kind of try to stretch out this notion of attention to cover the space that we usually talk about in terms of kind of the human will. And so at the individual level, our will can be undermined if we get distracted in the moment, but also if, you know, there are new habits that get sort of created in us over time, or if it's hard to keep track of what our values are, you know, what sort of self we want to be. Mm-hmm. So I think there's sort of these deeper senses in which our attention or our will can be undermined at the individual level. I think when that you look at the collective level, I mean, the will is the basis of the authority of democracy, right? Mm-hmm. So that's the idea then that there's something about that authentic general will that can be undermined in the same way that our individual wills can be undermined. And so I think this attention economy, the sort of this race for our attention, it privileges, I think, a part of us that is very different from the self that democracy assumes, you know, the kind of the rational, reflective, mm-hmm. Considered forms of judgment. It sort of does an end run around all that and speaks to kind of that impulsive part of ourself that, you know, gets angry at the latest, you know, Trump tweet or whatever. So I think that there are similar dynamics essentially on the individual and the collective levels in this regard.
Yeah. Just talking about that, you describe how in your own use of social media, it's caused a proliferation of pettiness in your life. Pettiness meaning pursuing this kind of low-level goal as though it were a higher one, as you describe it. So can you tell me a bit about that? What have you noticed about yourself?
Well, I mean, I think it's probably what a lot of people, you know, have noticed about their own usage is, like, you know, I found myself caring about number of likes or whatever on social media, not because it was sort of in itself important, just because it was this thing that was measured and more is better, you know. So I think that it's sort of, you know, it's a short term versus the long term in a sense, kind of in direct competition with each other.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about Donald Trump, who you say takes this idea of pettiness over prudence to new heights? That's a quote. So does Trump's use of Twitter have implications for the way all politics is carried out?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's going to be hard to go back to sort of the pre-Trump way of doing things, I think. This is what people didn't realize about him during the election, I think, is just the degree to which he just understood the way the media works and could orchestrate it. And I think he was just so far out ahead of everyone else in knowing how to do that. But now people are learning from him and taking a page out of this playbook. And I still feel like there's this feeling among people who are, you know, who oppose him and everything he's sort of about that, you know, when he's out of office, like, we'll just go back to the way things were before. But I don't think there is going back as long as these media dynamics remain as they are. In a way, I think we ought to be more concerned about what comes after Trump than what we have with him.
Yeah, can you expand on that? Because you've described it as the fact that we've sort of misread him by thinking of him in informational rather than attentional terms. So what's that difference that you're getting at there?
It was kind of on very stark display in the debates when he was debating Hillary Clinton, you know, the split screen on one side, it's her talking about policy positions, facts, data, et cetera. And on the other hand, it's him essentially kind of being an entertainer, right? And, you know, Neil Postman talked about this, you know, in Amusing Ourselves to Death, like kind of the idea that politics is being reduced to entertainment. But I think I feel like with Trump, it's sort of the next level of that, where it's not just entertainment, it's almost like not amusing ourselves to death, but rewarding ourselves to death. Like, and I think particularly in his use of outrage, because that is, you know, a reward because it gives us a sense of moral clarity, of, you know, solidarity with others. But it kind of plays into this, I think, this general tribalizing of politics that's happening. And one of the things I talk about in the book is this notion of populism, which is still a kind of vague notion, I think. But I was really influenced by a book by Jan Werner Mueller at Princeton, who the way he talks about populism is essentially a kind of moralizing of the political realm, where people take politics as a moral playing field, or kind of, so you have these different moral tribes. And I feel like, at least in the U.S. context, this is really what's happening. And so I think that giving people the opportunity to be outraged gives them the opportunity to signal that they're part of a moral tribe. Mm. And so it's, even if it's not sort of strictly entertainment, it's a kind of psychological reward or psychological value that plays into this sort of relentless tribalization of politics that we've been seeing.
And so what's the implication of that kind of, as you say, tribalism or the culture of outrage on our ability to have a democratic politics?
Well, I think the risk is that we lose sight of what we have in common. We lose sight of the values that we share or are supposed to share. We lose sight of what it means for people to be part of the same society. And I guess the eventual risk is of a fragmentation of one sort or another. I think that's why it's so important to be finding ways that, you know, our media can still enable debate and dissent and diversity of viewpoints, but at the same time, keep in view that North Star that we all share, you know, what the society is supposed to be all about.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Spark. I'm Nora Young, and I'm speaking with James Williams. He's the author of Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Persuasion in the Attention Economy. I mean, one of the things that really struck me in the book is this metaphor you have of daylight, you know, that it's not just that because we scrolled through Instagram for an hour, we didn't clean the house. It's that we're losing our ability to think about, you know, the broader picture of our lives, that what, you know, the good life in a philosophical sense actually is. Can you spell that out a little bit for me?
I kind of use this metaphor of light in the book. So when people talk about attention, cognitive scientists, sometimes they talk about the spotlight of attention. So what you're giving attention to right now, you know, in this moment. Then I talk about sort of two other lights, the starlight, which would be kind of our values, our sense of identity and the ways that can be undermined. And then kind of at the deepest level, it's the daylight, which is not just how we pursue tasks or goals or things like that in our lives, but how we come up with those in the first place, how we undergo those processes of reflection, of kind of that internal dialogue that has to happen in order for us to know what we want to do with ourselves in the first place. And so there are various ways in which I think kind of this competition for attention undermines that, you know, one of which is, I think, colonizing these moments of leisure. And a lot of times we conflate entertainment with leisure. We think it's just, you know, having fun. But in, strictly speaking, leisure is kind of that downtime where, in some sense, our authentic interests ourselves can kind of bubble up from the surface. You know, it's kind of these moments of reflection and habits of reflection we need to have in order to be a person at all. Mm. That's, I think, the ultimate risk of all this, is that not just if we sort of are unable to reach those values, but if we forget what those even are in the first place, or even how to define them, I think then we'll be in, you know, sort of this general state of confusion. I think it would be hard to come back from.
But do you think it's really that serious? I mean, do we really risk losing touch with that kind of North Star or that sense of what our life is for if we don't keep checking in?
I think so. I mean, I think also the backdrop of all this is that, you know, in a secular kind of world, which, you know, it has given us so many, you know, great benefits to the extent that it's kind of liberated the individual's ability to do with their own thing. It kind of dismantled this, you know, these habits and processes that we had kind of iterated over, you know, centuries, if not millennia. And there's actually this German philosopher, Peter Sloterdijk, says that, you know, we should reclaim that aspect of religion. He calls it anthropotechnics, and I love that word. You know, those stories that we had used to define what we're about, what the world is about, are gone. And then now we're sort of, it's even harder than it would otherwise be to sort of create our own stories.
Mm-hmm. So the situation that we're faced with is serious, obviously, and the task is to bring the technologies of attention onto our side again. And one of your suggestions is to move advertising away from capturing our attention and towards supporting our intentions. So how do you imagine that kind of scenario playing out?
It's a good question. I think there are a lot of ways that it could play out. You know, advertising has been around for a long time, but mm-hmm. I think there's something qualitatively different about the advertising we have now, in the way that it's not sort of underwriting the media that we have that are designed for some purpose. It's kind of overriding it. I think its goals have kind of taken over. I mean, I think, you know, my aim with this book was really to articulate the problem and sort of give a few intuitions about the direction that this could go. But probably what needs to happen is just a rethinking about at the societal level about the nature and value of advertising. It's something that, you know, curiously is so prevalent in our lives. You know, it's one of the places we're already interacting with the most sophisticated AIs in the world in advertising. Mm-hmm. But there's curiously, you know, very little, you know, societal, regulatory, public scrutiny about what advertising is and does. And so some way of bringing it from the background into the foreground, I think, would be a good starting point.
I mean, I guess part of the problem is that advertising is what pays for all the free stuff that we get online, which, of course, people want.
Right. I mean, I think it was interesting, you know, amidst all the recent Facebook and Cambridge Analytica kind of brouhaha, the most interesting thing that I saw in that was when Mark Zuckerberg was giving an interview to, I believe, Ezra Klein of Vox, and he said something to the effect of advertising is the only rational model that could enable them to give Facebook to, you know, the world. And I thought that was a remarkable statement for, you know, somebody, a champion of innovation in an industry that prizes disruption, to say, no, this is the only possible thing. It's the only possible way to make money. So, you know, I think there's a curious aversion to innovation and disruption when it comes to innovating and disrupting one's own, you know, money-making machine. But, I mean, it's not that surprising, I guess. But it was interesting because it was one of the first kind of explicit kind of defenses of advertising that I've really heard him or many of the other kind of tech, you know, titans make. So I think the more that we can just have explicit conversations about, like, I think that nobody really has a good definition of what advertising actually is anymore.
Yeah.
And in my doctoral research, this is one of the things that I kind of focused on was, given what advertising has been in the past, is it still that? And I don't think it really is. I don't think anybody has any clue anymore what advertising is.
Why do you think we don't know that it's still advertising any longer?
Well, I mean, the way advertising has always been, you know, framed historically, it's been like this exception to the rule. Been, like I said, it was underwriting the program or the higher purpose. But I think in digital context, the boundary that separated, you know, the exception from the rule has been broken down. And so, you know, and I think there's even a South Park about this. I think they got this really well. You know, it's kind of all an ad now. And I think a lot of the reason is because the kind of the goals of advertising have infiltrated the goals of media as a whole. Web analytics systems, I think, have played a big role in this and kind of putting these kind of petty engagement metrics like clicks, views, et cetera, kind of just installing them as the default metrics for these systems. So nobody can really say where advertising begins and ends. It's sort of become this all-encompassing persuasive environment.
Mm-hmm. So the book is sobering, and yet, you know, the internet can still be amazing. I mean, it still has the power to offer us delightful, moving, hilarious, powerful things, and especially the way it opens us up to the potential for collaboration. Do you have some optimism there?
I think I'm optimistic that there's more attention than there was, you know, even a year ago to, like, the political economy of technology industry and these devices, these systems that we trust to guide us through the day and guide us through our lives. There's more attention than there was. I think if we can have the right sort of conversations and keep our eye on the prize, I think I'm optimistic. I worry, though, that we, you know, when it comes to talking about these issues of persuasion, manipulation, you know, propaganda, whatever, these problems that are essentially attentional problems, mm-hmm. We keep slipping back into these informational ways of talking about them.
Can you just expand on that about the, because this isn't a key distinction, the distinction between this informational way of thinking about things and the attentional way of thinking about things?
Yeah. So, I mean, one foundational distinction that I draw on in the book, and I think I might have mentioned this last time I was on the show, is Herbert Simon's distinction, the economist from the 1970s, who said that you know, when information becomes abundant, attention becomes the scarce resource. And I think so many of the systems and rule sets and the language that we have for talking about power is about the power to sort of control information, because that was historically the scarce thing. So I think in light of Simon's distinction, now what we need to be concerned about is the management of attention just as much as the management of information.
So when we talk about somebody like Donald Trump and his use of Twitter, it's not just a question of the informational content of what he's saying, it's the question of the attention that he is taking up. Is that right?
But yeah, like the content of what he says is not really, not nearly as important as kind of the way in which the things he says direct people's attention, whether that's distracting from some other issue he wants to distract people from. Other people do this as well. You know, the Chinese government has long suppressed information that it found objectionable, but now that the technique is one of what some researchers called strategic distraction. So it's instead of censoring the information, you flood social media with millions and millions of other posts that just distract people's mm-hmm. attention away from it. It's this idea that the management of information is not really what we should be concerned with. It's more of the management of attention.
Mm-hmm. James, thanks so much for telling us about your book. I really enjoyed reading it.
Thanks for having me. Glad you liked it.
James Williams is the author of Stand Out of Our Light, Freedom and Persuasion in the Attention Economy.